was meant to me, and KPFT is pretty much the radio embodiment of what I think the Houston music community is. We would be lost without them. So hope you keep listening, donate, support. You'll hear us sometime soon.
Hi, I'm Al Stahaley, and you're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1.
You miss your woman, and I miss my man too.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
That is the percolating beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees. And that means it's 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston's community radio. Well, I'm your host today, Eric Heen, backed up by the most talented team on radio. And here on So What's Your Story, we bring you guest storytellers every week who'll take us on magical journeys through their stories before landing us safely back into the present. Well, now we're going to hear from Sam Foster. Sam, why don't you introduce yourself?
Delighted to, Eric, and thank you for having me on.
You bet.
The first thing I want to say to your audience, knowing that you're out of Houston, is I was born in Potter County General Hospital in Amarillo, Texas.
Ah.
And my mother's family is from Amarillo. So when the war was over and I was only a year old, they moved back to Illinois, which was my father's ancestral home. So
World War II, you're talking about.
World War II, yeah. I'm sorry.
Younger people, when you say the war, they don't always, okay.
Point well taken. You're right. I'm showing my age already. So My growing up, my rearing, my background is a small town in Illinois, and that will play out further in our conversation. But that ancestral home is a place called Beardstown, Illinois. It is on the Mascouten Bay on the Illinois River. And it was in the 19th century, one of the richest and most prosperous cities in the state of Illinois, because it was the river port that handled all freight traffic for everything in the middle of the state.
Right.
Virtually every piece of lumber that went into building the Illinois State Capitol in Springfield came through that little port. And it was in the 20th century, it died completely because river traffic simply faded away in favor of the railroads.
Sure.
My ancestors were smart enough to pass a bond issue to float a railroad bridge across the Illinois River to get the railroad to come through their town to replace the river traffic. And indeed they did that. And part of the deal was that the railroad would also put a roundhouse and a shop there. So at one point up until the 20th century, it was a town of a population of some 12 or 13,000 people, of which, now imagine this, 1,000 of them worked for the railroad.
Wow.
I mean, if you're not working for the railroad, then your customers are people who do work for the railroad. The railroad was the thing.
Got it.
And in 1939, the railroad moved out. And they moved out for some fascinating reasons. And I only tell your audience this because if they read the story of Beardstown, they will get this in detail. But the Beardstown, Cass County, Illinois, was such a Democratic county in the 19th century that they didn't vote for Abe Lincoln, even in 1864, after he'd won the war. They didn't vote for him. They didn't vote for him in 1860. They didn't vote for him in 1864. Okay. And he was from right down the street. Springfield is not 50 miles away from Beardstown.
Sure.
So there were, as many of your older people in your audience will know, there were huge union issues in the 1930s. Could unions be formed? Should they be formed? What were the limits of their power? And particularly with the railroads around Chicago, there were some very violent strikes where the railroad would hire Pinkertons to come in and try to beat up the strikers. And so the strikes would arm themselves with axe handles and baseball bats, right, things that make our union issues look like nothing as of today.
Yeah.
And downstate Illinois is and always has been rather independent rather than group minded. And it votes Republican. It still does. But Chicago and the bigger cities vote Democratic, and they're heavy on union labor, as many Democratic places are and were. Well, Beardstown was also one of those places. And so Beardstown took the Chicago attitude that we're going to get what we want, and damn what the cost of it is. But in downstate Illinois, the railroad didn't have to put up with that because they could go other places and take all those jobs to other communities that wanted them there. So in 1939, they moved out. The city is now, the last time I was there, where you got the little sign on the outside of population that says population town, that said 5,800. That's down from 12,000. And there are literally lots in the residential section of towns where the housing has been knocked down to the foundation and a double wide trailer put on it. It's an absolutely dying little Midwestern town, as many towns in the Midwest are.
Right.
So when it was time for me to go to school, I never gave any thought whatever to coming back to Beardstown, Illinois and finding a job. I mean, I didn't even consider it to dismiss it. I never remember thinking the thought. There was nothing here for me. And so I went to Los Angeles to college. And my college career was like many men my age. I was graduated in 1966. And every man in America that graduated from college in 1966 had a choice for a graduation trip. You could go to Canada or you could go to Vietnam. Those were your two choices. And so the first thing I did, and in all honesty, my choice was based on a little wisdom from Socrates that I actually learned in college. I was not a great college student, but I learned to love learning. And Socrates had said at one point that when the polis calls, a man only has two choices. He either says yes and goes along, or he says no and then stands in the town square and said, punish me as you will. You and your audience may know this, but everybody thought when they condemned Socrates to death that he was going to bribe his way out of jail and go to Thebes. That was sort of the general opinion of town. And he didn't. He lived by his own rules. He stood in the middle of the town square and said, I won't do to me what you will.
He took the hemlock.
Exactly right. He took the hemlock. So I have always been a great admirer of Muhammad Ali, because as you may remember, if you're old enough, that was the course he took. He didn't run anywhere. His famous quote is, I can't kill them poor people. And he simply stood and said, do to me what you're gonna. I'm not going anywhere, but I'm not going off to war. And as you know, he lost his license to box in various states. Economically, it was hard on him. But my choice was the opposite. I took the other path of Socrates. I simply joined up and I joined the Marine Corps. When I got out of the Marine Corps, maybe your audience
Hold up here, Lisa. Did you go to Vietnam?
I did not. And I'm entirely willing to tell you why.
Okay.
I joined up to the Marine Corps and I spent 5 months in the hospital on a training accident. And after the training accident was over, I spent another 4 months in a recovery battalion trying to get up to full strength to go back to training. Rule was during Vietnam, I only signed a 2-year contract. I wasn't trying to be a hero. I was trying to do what was owed and no more than that.
Get out. Yeah.
I signed a 2-year contract, and the rules at the time were it took 15 months to go to Vietnam. That was 13 months in country, a month going and a month coming back. And by the time I got back on full duty, I had exactly 15 months left. They didn't send me off the first month. And after that, I was doing nothing but hanging around Quantico, Virginia for the next year. So there's nothing heroic in my service at all. And at the time, I admit it, I was a young man who had a young man impulses, and I kind of wanted to test myself against war. But I didn't want that badly enough to give him another 3 years and say, okay, sign me up again. As an old man, I'm really delighted that I was never called upon to kill anybody. when I was young, I didn't even think about it. As an old man, I think, oh, I'm so fortunate that I did my duty, but I wasn't called upon to pull the trigger.
Sure.
I'm like, I think a lot of people my age, I didn't think we were poor. I thought we were like everybody else, but I slept on the couch until my older sister left home. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money. And when I got out of the service, I remember going to an employment agency in Washington, D.C., and I held up two documents. I held up a diploma in one hand, bachelor's degree, liberal arts and sciences, and I held up a discharge paper in the other and said, what's the most money you can get me? Huh. It wasn't about passion. If I had a passion, it was for writing, but I was not one of those people who was willing to be in a little upstairs attic with inadequate heat and starving for art. That was not me.
Starving artist wasn't for you, huh?
I wasn't that passionate. Mm-hmm. But when I was at the stage that many people get to, where I had my mortgage mostly paid off, I had my kids paid their way through college, I had money in an IRA, I was beginning to develop retirement, and I no longer had to work 60 and 70 hour weeks, I started to write. When I started writing, I did what I think an awful lot of writers do, and I think is reasonable. I wrote about things I knew personally. Sure. So I could fill out sentences with a little color. And one of the first books that I wrote was called Non Semper Fidelis. And it was nominated for a Pushcart Award. Most of your audience won't be familiar with pushcarts.
We've had Pushcart Award winner on our show.
Okay, then maybe your audience understands. I did not win, but I was nominated as Novel of the Year.
Sure.
And many of your listeners will know that the motto of the Marine Corps is Semper Fidelis, the translation being always faithful. And the title of my book is Non Semper Fidelis, which does not translate to not faithful. It translates to not always faithful. It is the story of the use of power. And it is a story that is set entirely stateside. There's not a shot fired in anger in the whole book. It's not about that. When Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, we had race riots in my battalion. And the Marine Corps is, and I think most of your listeners will agree with this, but it guards its reputation more jealously than any of the other services. Mm-hmm. Huh. And my story of Non Semper Fidelis is the use of power. I found that there were two kinds of Marines. There were career Marines, lifers, who were indeed Marines. And virtually all of them, they may be mean as hell, or they may be gentle as a lamb, but they all understood power and how to use it and how not to use it. That was very clear to them. Hmm. The other people in the Marine Corps were guys just like me. They were straight out of school. They weren't career warriors. And a bunch of them had gone to OCS because the Marine Corps was more than doubling its size in the period of just a couple of years. And it needed these people. And it would send them to OCS for 90 days, and then they would have power over hundreds of lives. And some of them were really good at the way they used it. But many of them, as you can imagine, were young men who were scared to death, not of their own mortality, but the power they had and how to use it. And most of them were afraid they'd screw up, they'd do it wrong. And so guys like that tended to do exactly what the book said, so that no matter how it came out, they could cover their butt. They could say, I did what was required of them. My experience was the men who were really good at power went by the book most of the time, but the book was a guide. And if that wasn't what was going to serve the purpose, they didn't use it. And so I have two young men that create exactly the same offense. That is, they're AWOL for a very short period of time. They don't abandon the Marine Corps. They don't go running off. They just don't get there on time.
Right.
And one of those cases is adjudicated by a career lifer, top gunnery sergeant who had two Navy crosses and had been at Pork Chop Hill. And the way he adjudicated it was to scare the young man to death, but not damage him, not do what the book said. Mm-hmm. And he got from that an incredibly dedicated Marine who understood that the Marine Corps was one, human, and two, would serve him well if he served it well. The other one was a young second lieutenant who was trying so hard to prove that he was a Marine, that he walked around the base with a white German Shepherd on a choke job. And that immediately describes what kind of guy he is. Mm-hmm. And in handling exactly the same infraction, he crushed the young man and effectively ruined his life. Mm-hmm. So that book is just an exploration of power. That's all it is.
So apparently there's some underlying moral there about inflexibility or...
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I was in business for 35, almost 40 years. And it is people who may claim they're not flexible, may claim they have a full set of rules, may claim that they expect everybody to behave in the following way, but break those rules themselves when it serves their purposes, that are generally the best leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But that book, that experience was in the late 60s. The book came out in 2014 or 15. And I say in the beginning of that book, number one, that it's fiction. Number two, that when it all happened 35 years ago, I knew everything that happened and I knew it better than I remember it now. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have any idea what it meant. It took me 35 years of ruminating that on my drives in commuter traffic back and forth to come to a clear understanding of what that was about.
Huh.
So that book was about something I understood. Then I want to go back to Beardstown, and I've tried to do this in a bio sort of way because that was the question you asked me. But when I was a young man growing up, I lived in Beardstown, Illinois. And it was, as I said earlier, this river port, which had been a place of magnificence for a while. To give you a sense of how important it was to compare to that it's completely meaningless now. Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas spoke there. It was not one of the sites of their famous debates, but as most of your readers won't know, Douglas wouldn't debate Lincoln because there was no reason to. Everybody knew Douglas and nobody knew Lincoln. It was almost like Trump not going on the Republican debates earlier in the year. Right. I'm not going to give them power and glory. I'm known. They can dig it out for themselves. So what Lincoln started doing was shadowing Douglas. And if Douglas would speak, Lincoln would be there the next day and he'd speak. And finally, Douglas said, all right, we'll have debates. So this wasn't one of their debates, but this was literally Stephen Douglas spoke there one day and Abraham Lincoln spoke there the other day.
Right.
To show you how close it is to Lincoln, in Beardstown, they still have a courtroom, which is the only courtroom that Lincoln ever practiced in that is still a working courtroom. They had immense amounts of history. I'll give you another one that's great history on this little town. Wyatt Earp got in his first gunfight in Beardstown, Illinois. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of background about America moving west that came out of that little river port. Hmm. And so I grew up with all of these stories. My grandfather was one hell of a shot and he ran a duck club. He could train dogs. During the Depression, nobody had money enough to go hunt with him. And so his business was really on hard times. And he never used wooden decoys. They didn't have plastic decoys then. He used live decoys. And people not with a hunting license, but people with a license to guide or run a lodge could trap ducks and use them for decoys. And they just tie a string around one leg and tie a brick around the other end and leave a bunch of extra string and throw the brick in the water and then put some corn out to feed the ducks, just shovel it out. And the ducks would quack around and make happy sounds, and that would attract the other ducks. Well, it was legal after duck season was over to, quote, harvest your decoys. And they, if you serve somebody a duck or sold a duck, it damn near better not have any lead pellets in it. That would get you in trouble. But if it had had its neck wrung and you had the license to be a guide or run a lodge, you could still harvest your decoys. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather made it through the Depression by, quote, harvesting decoys, cleaning them, taking suitcases full to Chicago, and walking down the back alleys of where fabulous hotels are and supplying the cooks with ducks. At one point, Frank Nitti and Al Capone used to take the ferry, both of them, down from Chicago to come there and hunt. So you could imagine they had a few clients there, and pretty good whiskey was available in Beardstown, Illinois, when other people were running bad whiskey. It was just fraught with wonderful stories, all of them about people who made their own rules, mm-hmm. all of them about frontier spirit, because that town made itself rich on frontier spirit. It did not make itself rich by a whole codex of laws that it enhanced forcefully. Mm-hmm. There is an elected position, elected county by county in Illinois, called state's attorney. And a state's attorney is kind of like an attorney general. A state's attorney has the power to indict and the power to prosecute in the same office, not separate office. So a very special firm. Well, the state's attorney in Beardstown famously said one time, if justice is blind, how can she see which way the scales are tilted? And his attitude was, not so much what the crime was, but who committed the crime. And it wasn't so much that he was corrupt or that they were corrupt. It was, what have you done for the city? What kind of citizen are you? Do you contribute money to the school board? Do you? And based on those decisions, if it was some petty infraction, he'd just look the other way. He wouldn't do it. Yeah. So that was my history growing up in the town. That it wasn't that people were crooked, but it depended on who you were, what you got away with. Right. And so I'd grown up with all of these stories, and I wanted to write them. And I suppose there's just some of my hometown in the stories.
Right.
So I retired 7 years ago, and that's when I started writing. And I originally wrote it and thought it was one story. That is to say, from 1769 to 1999, I still think it's one story. But when it got to the publishing house, the deal became this. If you insist it's one 1,300-page story, nobody's going to read it, because Americans do not read Tolstoy-esque length novels. They're good luck, pages. Go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But if you break it into a trilogy, right, they're pretty good stories. So that's why it's a trilogy. It's not my preference. It's the marketplace's preference. And I'm one of those guys who believes you got to bow to the marketplace. You're a fool if you don't buy a mortgage, unless you've got a better idea than the whole rest of the marketplace. And so it broke fairly easily. Interestingly, there were breaks that made it easy. And it broke easily between 18th, 19th, and 20th century stories. The first one is the 18th century story. And the title of that book is A Panther Crosses Over. And the reason for that title is many of your readers will know or have heard of Tecumseh. He was so famous at the time that William Tecumseh Sherman, the famous Yankee general who marched to the sea, was named for him.
Right. Yeah.
In fact, William Tecumseh Sherman's name was not William until he went to West Point. His name was Tecumseh Sherman, and he gave himself a Christian name when he went to West Point. And Tecumseh and his brother, his elder brother, are probably responsible for getting more white people killed than Sitting Bull or Geronimo or virtually any of the Indians' names we know. But he was incredibly popular with the population he was warring against because he acted in what they thought was a civilized way. Mm-hmm. He spoke English. He could read and write English. But when I say he acted in a civilized way, one of the things that he would not do and would not allow anybody who went to war with him to do was torture. Mm-hmm. And his attitude, and he got famous in the Shawnee for doing this, but his attitude was, they're our enemy. They deserve to die. They're human beings. They deserve dignity.
Well, so how does Tecumseh fit into the trilogy here?
That title is his name. That is the English translation of Tecumseh, A Panther Crosses Over. The reason he's named that, the night that he was born, a fairly famous comet went right over the place where he was being born. And it was famous among the Shawnee. It had a green tone to it. And so his name was sort of instantaneously, it was known. He was born when the panther, and they called it the Panther. That's what the Shawnee called it. Now, I will say about that story that number one is that story has been told quite frequently. The American settlers rushing down the Ohio River, all the Daniel Boone stories. I mean, those stories have been told over and over again.
Right.
The thing that is unique about A Panther Crosses Over is that it's entirely from the Shawnee perspective, entirely. And it's not the author, that would be me, that's not my intention to revile William Henry Harrison and all of the American settlers that ran down the Ohio River after the French and Indian War. It's just that the book is written from the Shawnee perspective because I found that more interesting.
Huh.
And so that's what the battle is. And so rather than making Little Turtle, who was the chief of Miami, who just slaughtered St. Clair's army with, and he had some Shawnee along with him, I put it all in one place. I put it all with the Shawnee. And Tecumseh is, he is particularly interesting because he came from quite a large family. He had five brothers, one of whom was adopted. In fact, the most famous of his brothers is seen in all the literature as Blue Jacket, is seen with an Anglo-Saxon name. And he was captured by the Shawnee when he was 17 years old. And his capture was quite famous, at least among the Shawnee. But they had gone all the way down the New River into Virginia. And he was out hunting with his kid brother, who was 10 years old. And he was 17 at the time. And the Shawnee party simply surrounded them. And everybody knew, everybody there knew the Shawnee were going to win, but they also knew that kid could kill one of them. He had one shot in that gun and he could. And he made a deal with them. And the deal was, you let my little brother go. You let him go back home. I'll go with you. Nobody gets killed.
Huh.
And so they took him and he had a tongue for languages. And he studied Shawnee hard as they paddled up the New River and then down the Ohio River to where they came from. And he had learned some Shawnee by the time he got there. They were rough on him, but they didn't torture him on the trip. And he had expressed clearly that he wanted to become a Shawnee. And when they got back to their village, they said, well, maybe we'll let you be a Shawnee, but you're not yet. And so you're going to have to do what all prisoners do. You're going to have to run a gauntlet. And if you can stay alive until you touch that pole in front of that guest lodge over there, we'll talk about adopting you. And he did. And most famously in his running the gauntlet, he had gotten very close to the end and some warrior stepped out in front of him with a club and literally stepped into the lane, which they're not supposed to do. They're supposed to give the lane to the runner and stepped into the lane and tried to club him with the club and knock him down so he'd never get there. The kid ducked, took the club away from the warrior, clubbed the warrior upside of the head, and then ran and touched the pole. And he said later on in life, he didn't know if he was going to get killed for that or not. He didn't know if he was turning around and not just ducking blows and fighting. They broke into applause. That was their attitude of a warrior. This is a kid we like. And he was adopted. His father had been war chief of Shawnee, a guy named Puxinwa. That was who adopted him. And he followed his father in that. And he maybe because of his understanding, maybe he was 17 when he was adopted and he had some understanding about warfare and guns and how they were used. But he led two famous battles, one of which over 650 white people were killed. And it was some full armies came in and tried to do it. Tecumseh's next older brother was a guy named Chicsikah, who everybody had thought would follow his father. He was a brilliant warrior. And in fact, he carried his dying father off of the battlefield at the first full-on army engagement ever fought east of the Appalachians. He was killed there. His kid carried him off the battlefield. Tecumseh was after him, and then Tecumseh had three brothers that were triplets, the first set of triplets in three generations among the Shawnee. And he had only one sister. His sister was older than him and was his number one political ally his entire life. She understood how everything worked among Indians, how you could consolidate, how you could get them to work together. And when Tecumseh started to rise and become the Tecumseh we know and sort of taking over Indian politics and leadership, all of his family had leadership positions. And the thing that I find so fascinating in the story was that all of them turned against him in the end. His older brother, Blue Jacket, who was the only chance of getting the Shawnee to come with him. The Shawnee, his own tribe, didn't like him. They thought he was too arrogant and cocky and he wouldn't have anything to do with the existing infrastructure of the tribe. And Blue Jacket had become war chief, and his only chance of getting the Shawnee behind him was if his older brother did it. And his older brother dropped dead of a heart attack before he went to war. His older sister, who had handled all of his political relations with everybody, one of his rules was that anybody who followed him could not marry or have sexual relationships with anybody white. And she ran off with a French trader. He had one of his brothers that he made into another name some of your listeners will know, called the Shawnee Prophet. And he was William Henry Harrison's, what's the word I'm looking for? He was his tormentor. His name is Tinkswatwa. And Tinks was not the brains in the operation. He was a tool of his older brother, Tecumseh. But Harrison thought Tinkswatwa was the Shawnee Prophet because his brother had made him the Shawnee Prophet. One of the most famous things that ever came up between them was that Harrison was buying land. The Greenfield Treaty, in which all the fighting stopped, guaranteed the Indians that no white man could buy land. None, for any reason. No white man could take or buy their land. Only the government could do it. Well, William Henry Harrison was the governor of Indiana. That made him the government. That meant he could do it. And so he started buying Indian land. And Harrison's way of buying Indian land, and again, I'm not reviling Harrison. This is pretty good history. Was that anybody who said they owned it, Harrison would buy it from him. It didn't matter if they did or not. And he bought a huge tract of land from a Potawatomi chief, and the land belonged to the Miami and the Shawnee. So Tecumseh has his brother, Tinks, who is now set up as the prophet. He has him say that everybody who sells land to the whites is a witch, and everybody has an obligation to kill them on sight. So you can imagine a land sale stopped right then. So Harrison, who's not going to put up with this shit, Harrison was a tough dude and very capable. Harrison sends a note to Tinkswatwa, and he sends a copy of the note to every Indian village in the Indiana Territory that says, you call yourself a prophet. If you are, and Manetho listens to you, tell him to make the sun stop moving. And Tinkswatwa was terrified. He thought the jig was up. Nobody ever really knows how Tecumseh pulled off what I'm about to tell you, but he did read and write English. And he had Tinks sent a note back to Harrison, said, I can't do that because it's not within my power, but it is within Manetho's power. And he tells me he will do that for me 50 days from today, the sun will stop. And 50 days from today at high noon, there was a full eclipse of the sun. And so it just, all the Indians were in awe. And it absolutely ruined Harrison's deal about trying to buy land until he got rid of them. And Tecumseh knew that's why he had to get rid of them. That's why. Wow. And William Henry Harrison was so famous for having beat the Shawnee. And he beat them at the Battle of Tippecanoe. Their village was at the confluence of the Tippecanoe River with the Wabash River. And that's where he put an end to all of this with the Shawnee. And he was so famous for that, that when he ran for president, his slogan wasn't even his own name. It was his vice president's name. The slogan, when I say it, you're going to know it, was Tippecanoe and Tyler too. That's how famous he got for doing that. It made him president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that story is about. That story is about the conflict between the settlers and the indigenous population and how it played out politically and how it played out militarily. Hmm. And in the end, I don't mind giving the tragedy away. It's written from the Shawnee perspective, but we all know it did not work out well for Tecumseh.
Right, right.
Well, we're going to take a little break from our show for station identification and to make a few announcements. I'm Eric Keene, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? Right here on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. And now we're going to get back to our guest, Sam Foster, talking about his book, The American Trilogy.
Ben, the second book is pretty easy, and it goes pretty quickly. Okay. The second book starts out when two guys show up on horseback, and they have two things on their horses. They show up at a Potawatomi village on the Illinois River. They've got, the fighting is all over. It's done. They've got enough trade goods to live on, and one of them has got a surveyor's transom on the back of his horse. Mm-hmm. And he is there not to stake out a section and be a farmer. He's there to build a town. His name is Thomas Beard. That's what his intention was all along, to build a town. And the story goes from that simple starting to how he got people to come there. And he got people to come there by building a ferry across the Illinois River that they can put their Conestoga wagons on. So all of the land that was given as bounties to the people who fought in the French and Indian War was north of the Illinois River. And so they had to get across that river to get to what they could claim was theirs. But that's how Beard got people to come there. He built this ferry. And so all the wagons came through and some of them stayed. And he would make them good deals on lots, residential lots. But he knew what he needed. The first guy he gave the land to ran a sawmill. He also gave the land to a guy who ran a distillery. He sold land to a blacksmith really cheap. He knew what it took to make a town. And that's what he tried to create. So it starts with nothing there but an Indian village and two guys. By the time it ends, it is in opulence and wealth. It's not just that it's prosperous. It has developed cultural wealth. And the way I get there, there is a character that I create in this book who is entirely fiction, but it summarizes easily what happened. Her name is Vivian Divier. And Miss Divier grew up on a Southern plantation as a well-educated, prosperous, absolute aristocrat of the South. And during the Civil War, she finds herself living in a cave because Admiral Porter is bombing the city of Vicksburg into oblivion. And that was the place she had to run to. And she has some money. She has some cash in a valise that she got away with. And after the war is over, she doesn't want to reconstruct the South. She wants to go north where there is money. But she goes to Beardstown because she knows that it didn't vote for Lincoln either time he ran for president. And she thinks she'll find Southern sympathizers there. She thinks she'll be more welcome there. And she opens a place she calls Le Salon. And at Le Salon, you can get good music, good whiskey, but you can also get a bevy of Southern women, girlfriends of hers that she brought up out of poverty in the South, who will have dinner with you, who will play cards with you, who will discuss literature with you. And if they're inclined, they may take you to their room. If they're not, they have no obligation to. Le Salon is a really cultured place. She is trying to reproduce the South. And that's how it ends. The book starts out with simply these two guys with not even a log cabin, just starting there, and ends up with people drinking out of crystal, with a butler who opens the door in a tuxedo because tuxedos are the latest rage for help in London. Everybody is absolutely in front of it. A library with books in English, German, Latin, and the only book in Greek she's got, she keeps upstairs. Mm-hmm. Her major domo was a slave of hers in the South, and his name is Heracles. And when somebody corrects her and said, "Don't you mean Hercules?" she says, "My daddy's Greek was better than his Latin." It's that kind of atmosphere that they live in. That is the end of that book.
The second book brings us up to what time? I think about
1769 is the end of it. Oh, after the war. After the war. After the Civil War. I'm getting my wars confused. And then there is only one character that's transitioned from the first book to the second book. And that's one of the Indians who is the chief of that little Potawatomi village. So that was a very easy place to simply cut it and say, we've got a new cast of characters.
Okay.
But at the end of the second book, Beardstown, 1769, we jump to 1905. So there is a 35-year leap. Now, in the 35-year leap, there are four people who transition from the old book to the new book, but they were very young in the old book and they're very old in the new book. But they're transitional figures that carry some history with them. And in the new book, it is the story of decline. And the author tries to say what caused the decline. And it's not just that the railroad left. Beardstown, and Eric, when I tell you this, you'll go, oh yeah, that's why that name nags in the back of my head. Beardstown got famous once again in the 1990s, and it got famous brazenly. And when I say the Beardstown ladies, your mind just went, oh yeah. They were a group of 16 women who were from Beardstown, and they started an investment club. And they each put $25 a month in, which comes out to, rounded off, about $5,000 a year. And they were really quite diligent. They learned a lot. Their book, The Beardstown Ladies' Guide to Investing in the Stock Market, mm-hmm. I have read every word of it. And it's really good stuff. It teaches you how to read a 10Q and a 10K. It teaches you how to track a stock and follow it. It teaches you how to know what price earnings ratios are and what the, it's really good fundamental advice.
And but women were not educated in financial investment matters, correct?
That's right. I mean, they tried to go to Springfield to all of the investment advising houses, and nobody would touch them. Nobody would have anything to do with them. So they got pissed off and they formed their own club and did it themselves.
Okay.
Well, the cover of that book says, down in the lower right-hand corner of the front of that book, it said 21.4% annual profit for the decade of the 80s. Now, most of you, or no, not most, some of your audience will remember that after the crash of Carter, when Reagan came in, the market just exploded. And indeed, the average market returns were year to year something between 10 and 12% for the entire last 7 years of the 80s. But they were saying they blew the doors off that and virtually doubled it. And they became the darlings of everybody. These little blue-haired ladies from Illinois, from this little town that knows nothing about nothing, and on their own wit and wisdom, they are beating the market.
Right.
So Disney came to her They had been interviewed by Phil Donahue, the Wall Street Journal, all the East Coast papers had interviewed him. And Disney came to him. And at that point, Disney owned a publishing house. And Disney came to them and said, we would like to publish your book. We'd like you to write a book and we'd like to publish it. And so they did. And that's where the jacket comes from, with the 21.4% profit earnings. And that book sold for $10.95. They sold about 700,000 copies of it. I'm in the publishing business, so I've asked a couple of publishers about this. I've said, what do you think a contract would have looked like in the 1990s if the publisher went to them? They didn't go to the publisher. What kind of a deal do you think they'd offer them? And the answer I get is probably 15% of the net, and after a certain point, maybe going up to 20. Now, it's not real hard to do the math on $10.95 times 700,000 copies divided by 0.15 divided by 16 ladies to see what they made on the course of the sale of that book. That's not real hard math to do. And if you want to really have fun, take their $4,800 a year of annual investment in the market and multiply it times what they made in the market and see if they were making money selling books or if they're making money investing in stocks. That is not real hard to come by. What they made from books was life-changing. What they made from the investment in the stock market was not.
Gotcha.
And so everybody is interviewing the Bridgetown ladies. And the Chicago Tribune, I don't know if they still do, but they had a supplement simply called Chicago that was a Sunday supplement. And they sent one of their reporters down there to do a puff piece like everybody else had done on the Bridgetown ladies. Go down 220 miles, interview these ladies, and drive back. And he did something nobody else had done. He prepared for the interviews and he read their book. And he got looking at the book and he thought, 21%? Because you look at their book and they didn't list every buy and every sell they'd ever made. But they did list 2 years to show randomly, and they were showing how you do it, how you figure your returns and what you bought and what they did. And he did math on what they had published and went, nah, nah. And the thing that apparently triggered him was that their main, that they would express their investment philosophy of saying, do you like Kmart better than Target, or do you like Target better than Kmart? If you like Target, then buy Target because they've got a model that works for America. And this guy says, I thought to myself, that's not a market beating strategy. That's a market meeting strategy. And so he did some math just on what they had given him in the book. And he did interview him. He came back. But what they thought was a puff piece was titled, Beardstown Ladies Scam the Whole Nation.
Wow. He was the first one to figure that out, huh?
Yeah. And he was supposed to write a puff piece. Well, once he got to it, everybody went back and checked their numbers and hopped on board, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing about this that's interesting is that there was immediately a class action suit against Disney, because the Beardstown ladies don't have any money. Disney's got money. And it was a bunch of New York lawyers that originally started it. And interestingly to me, the courts in New York turned it down. The courts in New York would not take the suit.
Huh.
So the lawyers simply came to California, and California will take any suit. And the suit went through in California, and the settlement of the suit was really interesting. Settlement of the suit was, remember, Disney was in the publishing business at the time. And so they had a catalog. Everybody who'd bought the book got one free book in Disney's catalog. Picked any book in our catalog and we'll make it up to you for the book. Cash settlement was 1.7, which I'm pretty sure all went to the attorneys, although I couldn't prove that. I think that's, they didn't want a book. And the Beardstown ladies were found not culpable in any way.
Huh.
They admitted no guilt and none was passed on.
Well, I'm gonna have to Google the Beardstown ladies, get that. That's yeah, because I
the thing I want to tell you before I finish this, that is the end of the book. That is how it ends. But I'm the author, so I get to make of it what I want when I write it.
Sure, sure.
And my sense of the failing of Beardstown was that there was an attorney who came back after World War II who was from the family that had essentially run legal efforts in that town. Mm-hmm. He'd gone to school at Yale. He had been graduated at Columbia. He served in the Judge Advocate General's Corps during World War II in London and hung out with London society. He came back and he got out early because his dad died and the war was almost over. So rather than giving him leave to go home to dad's funeral, they gave him an early discharge like 4 months early or something.
Okay.
And when he came back to the funeral and the book, now, mind you, the book is a work of fiction. So I'm saying a lot of things that I don't know to be fact, but the general arc of the history, I do not change. As a writer of historic fiction, I believe that firmly, that I have a responsibility to the arc of the history. I don't have a responsibility to individual facts.
Okay.
And that's the case here too. So he came back and at his dad's funeral, everybody, all the business people in town, all the power came up to him and said, "We're so sorry about the loss of your dad. You know, we're going to need a state's attorney. We trust the family name." And they'd stick a $100 bill in his pocket. He gave all of the money back. This is what local history says, that he never took a dime. And local history says that he went around to every house in the county, which is, I don't think, possible. But he spent 6 months and he would say three things when he ran. He would say, "My name is, I am running for state's attorney. I would appreciate your vote." He never said anything other than that. Mm-hmm. And 2 days after he was inaugurated into office, he shut down every gambling game in town, including the penny ante game at the Elk Club.
Oh man.
He made him take the slot machine out of the drugstore. He absolutely cleaned up the town. He cleaned it up. And part of my sense is that, and the reason the name of the book is, and the name of the last book is American Pied Piper, that we all know the story of the Pied Piper, that it's in Grimm's fairy tales, and this little town in Germany named Hamelin was overrun by rats. And so everybody was getting the plague and they couldn't get rid of the rats. And this piper, or a flute player, came to town and said, "I can get rid of the rats." And the council in Hamelin agreed him to pay 1,000 guilders. I have no idea what a guilder is, but that's what the famous poem says. And he stood in the middle of town and he played his little flute and all the rats came to him and he went into the river and he drowned them all. That's the end of the story as most of us know it. That's not the end of the story if you read Grimm's. As you probably know, Grimm's fairy tales are pretty gruesome. The witch isn't the only person who got fried in her own oven in Grimm's. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't pay him. They wouldn't give him his money. So he walked back to the middle of the town and he played a different tune on his flute and all of the small children came to him and he walked them into the river and he drowned them.
Right.
That he got rid of the rats. And incidentally, people on river ports all through the Midwest call themselves river rats. He got rid of the rats, but he also got rid of all the creative vigor in the town. The creative vigor went away. And I am a huge admirer of the Beardstown ladies. By me, they didn't hurt a soul.
Sure.
They, if you read their book, you'll learn a lot about investing. It was a good damned book. And I think that indeed that was Beardstown's last hurrah with creative vigor that didn't give a shit what the rules were.
Yeah.
I think they were the Beardstown of the 19th century, not the 20th century. And I praise them. And so does the author who wrote the book. So I've given away all my bias there, but that's the story.
So the Beardstown ladies are definitely not villains in your book.
They are not villains. Although, remember I told you, Eric, that they have a courthouse there that Lincoln practiced in. It's still a courthouse.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They have a museum wrapped all around it. You got to walk through the museum to go out and pay your traffic ticket or contest it or whatever you got to do. Mm-hmm. And for Beardstown, when Beardstown came out, the head of the museum, the president of the museum, invited me to come speak. And I've been a public speaker most of my life. And I was thrilled to do it. I mean, you know, let's face it. The fantasy is young boy who left home comes back in a semi-glorious way, right? I mean, who could resist that? I couldn't have said no to that.
I was going to ask you about that, Sam. How are you received in Beardstown? Are you pretty famous there with all these writings? How's
it
going?
It's the biggest audience I've ever had.
Right. I bet.
And I admit, Eric, when I stood there, when they, I didn't think much when I got there. And when I stood there and I started to speak, all of a sudden it came to me that I was standing where Abraham Lincoln had stood. And I was speaking where Abraham Lincoln had spoken. And I choked up. I couldn't speak. And I literally looked at them and held my hands up and said, give me just a moment. I need to collect myself.
Sure.
I don't think it's ever happened to me in my life. But they were very nice and they were very kind to me. So when American Pied Piper came out, he invited me back. And I said, I would be delighted to come back, but have you read the book? And he said, no. I said, I'll accept your invitation. We'll set a date, but I want you to read the book. And you have every right to call me back and say you're not welcome, and I will understand implicitly.
Did he read the book?
So he did. He called me back and said, I think we're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had friends of my youth send me emails saying, this guy is pissed, and that guy's pissed, and another guy threw your book away and said he wouldn't have it on his bookshelf. So I'm going to go. I don't know how I'm going to be received. I mean, they're not going to throw stones at me, but I may have some grumblers, that's for sure.
Well, you can't write or say anything without pissing somebody off, so.
Well said, Eric. Well said.
Right. Well, the entire trilogy here is called the American Trilogy?
The American Trilogy. Okay. And the individual books are, number one, A Panther Crosses Over, mm-hmm. number two, Beardstown, number three, American Pied Piper. But the whole thing is the American Trilogy.
So, Sam, well, that about covers that trilogy then, the American Trilogy. So you got a website. And what's your website called again?
The website is samfosterbooks.com.
That would be the place to go to find out about you and these books, correct?
Yes.
Well, hey, Sam, I want to thank you so much for being our guest here on So What's Your Story?
It was fabulous of you to invite me. And if you don't cut it, a shout out to my friend, Johnny Fling, who is from East Texas.
All righty. Hello, Johnny. Thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that is our show for today, folks. I would like to thank our guest, Sam Foster, for his stories. And don't you dare move, because Living Art is up next with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson. Make 90.1 FM a part of your everyday life. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Well, it's all right. Wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a diamond ring.
Well, it's all right, even if they say you're wrong. Well, it's all right. Sometimes you gotta be strong. Well, it's
who does the word crooner bring to mind? Sinatra? Bing? Bublé? Well, if not for a terrible accident, Columbo might have headed that list. You're on The Sound Beat.
The breeze across the fairway, the blossoms over there, are telling us in their way, we'd make a peach of a pear.
You're listening to the Gus Arnheim Orchestra and Russ Columbo with A Peach of a Pear, recorded in 1929. Known as the Romeo of Song, he was a leading man on the silver screen as well. But a promising career was cut short by tragedy on the evening of September 2nd, 1934. on that night, he stopped by a friend's house. His host produced a set of Civil War-era pistols, as both were antique gun enthusiasts. Bravado conquered common sense as Columbo placed a match underneath the hammer and pulled the trigger, igniting the match, and a long-forgotten powder charge. The bullet ricocheted off a nearby desk, striking his head. He died 6 hours later. Of course, there are always conspiracy theories. Hear one at soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.